The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated.
Today, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of presentation, they are Deanna M. Lozano versus Juan Antonio Lozano Sr. and others from Harris County, Lee Lewis Construction Incorporated versus Norma Harrison individually and as an ex-friend from Lubbock County, and the Montgomery Independent School District versus Joanne Davis, also from Montgomery County. Not also, I'm sorry. We will listen to each of these three arguments, take a break in between the presentation of each one, and finish the three arguments before lunch. The court is taping these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument from the clerk for a nominal fee. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in the first case. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Lozano versus Lozano.
May it please the court. Ms. Eichelberger and Mr. Koenig will present argument to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Eichelberger will open the first 15 minutes. Mr. Koenig will present for rebuttal.
Good morning, Justices of the Texas Supreme Court. My name is Reba Eichelberger, and my associate, Paul Koenig, and I are honored to represent Deanna Lozano in the case before this court. That this case is important to the jurisprudence of this state cannot be contradicted. It involves the parent-child relationship, the Texas constitutional right to trial by jury, and it also brings up conflicting case law and a case that I think Warrick versus Warrick requires some additional rulings from this court so as to enable all practitioners who represent persons whose children have been abducted and they file a lawsuit under Texas Family Code 42.002 so that they will know exactly what the standard is required of them.
Could I get you to clarify some things concerning the assertion of the Fifth Amendment privilege?
Yes, sir.
The Fifth Amendment privilege, as I understand it, was initially asserted by some of the parties. First of all, would you identify which parties asserted the Fifth Amendment privilege?
Juan Senior, at his deposition on June 26, 1995, asserted the privilege, Fifth Amendment privilege, in response to a question as to any knowledge of the location of Bianca R. Juan Jr. And in the answers to interrogatories, all of the defendants took the Fifth Amendment when asked to give the names and addresses of friends and relatives in Mexico. They also took the Fifth Amendment as to who had assisted them in answering these interrogatories. And the interrogatories were filed on June 1, 1995. And I believe that this court could find that the Court of Appeals erred just by looking at the answers to the interrogatories.
Let me ask you this. It's true, is it not, that the Fifth Amendment privilege was not asserted at trial?
That's right, Your Honor.
I need to know the extent to which the Fifth Amendment privilege was even brought up at trial. I seem to saw some conflicting stuff about whether or not it was even brought up in front of the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. That was one of the key issues as to how did they aid and assist Juan Jr.
And but how was it presented to the jury?
It was...
But the Fifth Amendment privilege aspect.
The jury was informed that Juan Sr. had inserted it at his deposition.
And the jury was told only about Juan Sr.'s assertion?
No, Your Honor. They were given, as an exhibit, the answers to interrogatories.
But they later withdrew their assertion of the Fifth, is that correct?
Your Honor, They later withdrew them, but what you have to look at is the totality of circumstances.
What evidence was there that the assertion of the Fifth Amendment privilege aided and assisted Junior in keeping the child hidden?
Well, for one thing, if you don't have to give the information that you have, and this delay gives a person time.
What evidence was there that delay gave him time?
Well, I believe the ultimate fact, it will be 5 years in 2 days.
Did you go depose the people that they finally identified?
Your Honor, that they finally identified in their answers?
Yes.
Well, we were unable to do that because the answers that they gave were like, Mr. Gonzalez, address unknown. We did call the mother of Blanca, but in response to Detective Huron and others, she said she did not know where he was.
So what evidence was there that any of the people that were ultimately identified had any knowledge at all about the whereabouts of the grandchild or Junior?
Actually, Your Honor, they were never really identified sufficiently. There was no address, no telephone number. And I would be going outside the record to say what any investigator found.
What about at trial? Did you ask the trial court for an instruction to the jury on the failure, or excuse me, the assertion of the Fifth Amendment about any presumptions?
No, Your Honor, we just had broad questions.
Did you ask the trial court for any sanctions or any discovery penalties for the answers to interrogatories that were finally given after the Fifth Amendment privilege was revoked?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, actually, there was a sanction for failure to respond to discovery requests.
And what happened to that? It was granted or denied?
It was, one of the issues was we were asking for the address book of Blanca and of Sandra. And they kept resisting that, and finally the court compelled them. But the address
Fifth Amendment. What did you do with regard to the Fifth Amendment? Was there any motion in the trial court for delay, any kind of motion at all dealing with the Fifth Amendment once the privilege had been revoked?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Eichelberger, how long a period went from Ms. Lozano's request to her ex-husband's family to identify family members in Mexico before they actually had to identify whoever they identified?
Well, we sent the interrogatories and they filed the answer June 1 when they took the Fifth Amendment. In March, which the court can see, there's a long span of time when, in fact, they gave, say, the address book. And our position on this is that that was buying time. And you need three things for a successful abduction that obviously lasts 5 years. And one, you need time to run. You need financial and emotional support. And you need the absence of communication to the public, notifying them of this crime. And that, you know, the destruction of posters. Why would you destroy posters that inform the public that there is a $1,000 reward, that this person was last seen in a vicinity in Baytown? A detective testified, Crime Stoppers uses this strategy, and they have had a 48% clearance rate. He also testified that the destruction of these posters would, in fact, aid and assist a felon who is fleeing.
With regard to financial assistance, what evidence is there in the record of any financial assistance after Junior left?
Well, Your Honor, really, there is no evidence as to exactly when Junior left. Because although he picked up the child on April the 7th, 1995, there has been a great deal of, I don't know when the last time I saw him. When he really left, Your Honor, how do you determine when a person actually left the area?
Let me restate the question. After April the 7th, what evidence is there of any financial assistance to Junior after April the 7th?
Your Honor, I believe that the evidence shows that there were a lot of cash transactions between Juan Sr. and Eduardo, as well as Monica. And Monica did not bring her financial records In fact, I have included that in my request for judicial notice so that the court could just review the testimony that was given at trial that says which parties gave money. And I think when you look at the unexplained cash flow, Blanca cashed a check for $800. No explanation. She doesn't know what she spent the money on. Juan Sr. testified that he never gave his children any money except for food and room and board because they were living with him. But yet the evidence before the jury was he had in fact paid $5,000 for the attorney for Junior. He paid the bail's bondman when Juan Jr. failed to appear for his trial on April 20th and the bond was forfeited. He paid that money. Of course, it would be easy if a bail bondman is out chasing you if you pay the bail's bondman and that prevents that search.
Let me ask you this. It's obviously true that there is no direct evidence that Junior took Bianca. We are, to arrive at that conclusion, we are required to take inferences from evidence based upon circumstantial evidence. And my question concerns the equal inference rule. Why is your case distinguishable from some recent writing, such as I think it was the Walmart case, where the court said that if the inferences that can be drawn are equal, then you can arrive at no conclusion?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, that would really conflict with the no evidence rule that says you would look only at the evidence that supports the verdict and disregard all other evidence. So the only way that I think you could have two inferences that are consistent that would equal no, not a scintilla of evidence in using the no evidence rule would be if, say, two experts on the same side, one testified one way, one testified on the other way, and it cancels out. But if you're only looking at the inferences from the circumstantial evidence that favor the verdict, then you wouldn't even look at, say, the inference from the defendants. And in fact, that's where the Court of Appeals erred in this case. If you look at the opinion, they actually find financial assistance. But then they say, but it's unreasonable because the inference is not reasonable. Well, Your Honor, once you have found that financial assistance and you look at the totality of the circumstances, you're not supposed to look at it in isolation as the Court of Appeals did. If you look, they first knock out financial assistance as unreasonable. But they list there was financial a direct evidence, a $1,000 check from Sandra to Juan Jr. cashed on April 10th.
And when was that check was cashed on April 10th? That was at or close to the time that Juan Jr. disappeared with the child?
The question is, yes, Your Honor, he was supposed to bring the baby back on April the 9th. 1995. Okay. So
that was cashed right at the time that this was all occurring.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question about that. You had the posters were pulled down. The argument that has been put forth by Juan's family is that the poster had their personal home address on the poster, and so it was a privacy issue for them. And the concern would be that, they pulled the posters down. That is evidence of aiding and abetting. That's direct evidence of aiding and abetting because you're pulling down the posters. But is the inference that they intended to do that, can that be rightfully drawn when an equally valid explanation is that you were exposing their personal address as a part of that poster?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the posters were copies of the article that ran in the Baytown Sun that is distributed to approximately 25,000 readers, and that was just copied and put out as posters. The other thing is, we would be violating the no evidence rule if we considered the inferences that the Lozanos or Warner has put up, that in fact this was violating their right to privacy. They had no right to privacy as far as information that had already been published. It was a known fact that he was last seen at 605 Meadowick, Baytown, Texas. And as Detective Huron said, you do tell them the locality where a person was last seen so that if someone did see them in that area, they would come forward with the information. I believe that Judge Justice Lee, in his dissenting opinion, correctly finds the factual and legal sufficiency issues before this court. I think when he said you consider all the circumstantial evidence, and if you can reach a logical conclusion to support the verdict, then the verdict should stand. I would like to further address the fact that there has been, in the Supreme Court opinion, in little footnote 3, they said that we had inaccurately stated the evidence concerning Juan Jr.'s employment, and I would direct the court's attention to the exhibit that's attached to your excerpts, exhibit 13, and it shows that they brought papers showing that he had a job, but if the court will look at that, you will see that the last statement of any employment was April 1, 1995, and even the other evidence shows he has a sporadic work history. And the court said Dina first said that he had a job, and then she said, but she didn't believe he did. I believe that the court will look in the testimony of Dina that I have submitted to the court for judicial notice. She said that he had said he had a job, but he was 3 months back in child support, had not paid any child support, and in fact had not given the court his name or address of an employer. So,
any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Restrepo and Mr. Baring will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Restrepo will open with the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court. There were two issues relevant that were submitted to the jury as framed by plaintiff herself at page 8 of her brief. One, is there sufficient circumstantial evidence that any of my clients, the four people before us on as I represent, aided or assisted Juan Jr. in taking, retaining, or concealing the child from her mother? Second, is there sufficient circumstantial evidence that my client knew, and by this court's earlier pronouncements, that's an actual awareness, that their actions would aid or assist Juan Jr. in taking, retaining, or concealing the child from her mother?
How come pulling the posters down is not direct evidence of those issues?
Your Honor, because there are a number of inferences that must be taken. First, at most, there were four or five posters out of over 1,000 that were all
around. Because they're ineffective, that means that that's not aiding and abetting?
No, Your Honor. And the one reason that I respectfully disagree with the question is that, again, this is aiding, taking or concealing, knowingly taking, doing something to assist in taking, retaining, or concealing the daughter from the mother. Now, I submit that in order to do that, as it was the situation in Weirich and Smith, they knew where, so the first level is that they actually knew the whereabouts of either Juan Jr. or the child that did something.
Well, there's no requirement under the statute that they actually know the whereabouts, though, is there?
No, but there has to be.
The statute only requires knowledge of the order that's being violated.
Knowledge of the order, and it requires actual knowledge that what the acts you're undertaking aid and abet.
Well, if an abductor takes a child and doesn't say to someone where they are going, but they actually abduct the child, it doesn't protect the aider and abettor from liability merely because that person does not know where the child was taken, does it?
Your Honor, I think in order to show that there's a knowing, aiding, and assistance, that you would have to know that your conduct is somehow helping out.
Well, let's say that the abductor is aided by someone because of having been given money, and they head off saying, I'm not coming back, I'm not going to tell you where I am so that you won't be in a bad position. And the non-abductor, who is ultimately subject to a claim under the family code, then delays advising the person who's entitled to possession information that, in fact, the child is not going to be returned as required under the possession order. Why, in and of itself, is that not enough? If I can hold you off from checking it out and following up long enough, it gives the abductor time to get away so the abductor can't be traced. Now, why doesn't that scenario satisfy the requirements under the statute?
Your Honor, because I do not believe that the mere taking down of four or five...
No, sir, that wasn't my question. I mean, I'll let you get to that in just a second, if you don't mind. I'm just trying to understand what the statute means at this point in time.
And I understand, Your Honor.
And if the statute... I mean, do you disagree with that interpretation of the statute, that delay in and of itself, provided that there is knowledge of the order that is allegedly being violated, that knowledge that the child is being abducted or is not going to be returned in accordance with the order, knowledge of that coupled with delaying, providing information, revealing that fact, or so on and so forth, could not, in fact, constitute a violation of the statute sufficient to give rise to civil liability?
If you know all those things,
yes,
Your Honor, then I think that that might, okay, the jury, okay, could conclude that.
Okay, now go on about the post.
Okay, there's, and that's not that this point. Case, Your Honor, is what I'm saying. Because the last communication with the mother was just a communication that I won't be coming home. That's it. That's the last there is, and that's on Sunday the 9th. He was last seen on April the 7th.
But the mother knew so much more. The mother knew the child wasn't there. The mother knew that the child's laundry hadn't been done for days. I think it's a fair inference to be drawn from the evidence that the mother lied to Deanna. Why is that not circumstantial evidence to support the jury verdict?
Your Honor, because again, there's no, under the totality of the circumstances, as we've heard, given the nature...
If the jury, it's a fair inference that the jury concluded that Blanca lied to Deanna about Bianca's whereabouts. Why is that not sufficient evidence to support the jury verdict?
Your Honor, because it doesn't show that there's, still doesn't show that there's knowing, aiding, and assisting in the taking, retaining, or concealing of the child.
So I guess Blanca just thinks, well, golly, maybe the baby's gone. We don't need to worry about it.
Your Honor, she did not. The evidence in the record shows that she was concerned. She expressed her concern, and she called the police to try and get what we all know, what the evidence shows was efforts by numerous law enforcement agencies to try and locate the
when
child.
When did Blanca call the police?
The following Monday, Your Honor. It was Monday or Tuesday. It's in her brief.
Why did she never communicate with Deanna during the immediate days when Bianca was supposed to be back at Deanna's house?
Your Honor, the totality of the circumstances are is there was a bitter divorce going on in which my clients, the first thing when Deanna called up on Sunday when the child did not return home is that she immediately accused my clients of helping to in the abduction of the child. And that caused... and then kept getting calls, and under the circumstances that was unfortunately created between the families, I mean, my client, Ms. Lozano, was feeling hounded by it. She was distraught as well. I mean, the evidence shows that.
Let me ask you this, because this is genuinely difficult to believe. You're saying that as of the time of trial, and perhaps even to this day, Junior's family has no clue where Junior is?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. And that's what the evidence in the record shows. And there were, I mean, Your Honor, there's no evidence. I mean, there's all this speculation and surmise, really. And one of the things I wanted to address is Justice Doggett and the Reyna case, which we've cited. I mean, this is the case, this is the reason for the courts of appeals. There are difficult cases, emotional cases. The exhibits that were handed up to the court earlier today, the first exhibit is a color picture of the missing child. That was up before the jury. The record shows for the entire case. This is a difficult case, and Justice Doggett and Reyna said that our system of justice is designed to ensure that our fundamental right of jury, trial by jury, does not become some mere game of chance. There's it's speculation even to say that Juan Jr. and the child still are here or are in Mexico or whatever. I mean, just because my clients came from Mexico and have family and friends in Mexico, that was the only basis for the speculation that that's where they went to. There's no information about where they went. There's no information about how they got there.
But it's not necessary
for the family to know where he's at in order to violate the statute, is it?
Your Honor, I don't...
They can certainly aid and abet him in this effort if this is what's going on without knowing specifically where he's at. Don't you concede that?
But you got to... If you can show a connection between the delay and the inability to locate...
Well, it could even be the providing financial support. So they send the money to a post office box someplace, and it... We don't have any idea if he's there or not. So that money helps him do it. So there, I mean, is the answer to Judge Gonzalez's question that you concede the point that knowledge of where the child and her father are is not material to deciding whether there is a viable?
I think it's material. I don't think if the instance that Your Honor just mentioned, that would show assistance.
But
if you send a check off there,
it's not necessary to know where the child is to prove a claim.
Your Honor, I think that it is, but I think that even if it's not, that's not the case that's before this court.
Can we get back to the posters? I'm just curious about
this. Yes, Your Honor.
You said, how could tearing down four posters assist? Well, first of all, I would ask, how many would it take? And then secondly, does this statute require that the aider and abettor be, that assistance be effective assistance? Doesn't it merely require that there be assistance in order to violate the statute?
It requires knowing assistance in the taking, retaining, or concealing of the child.
So we may agree that taking down four posters may not be very effective assistance, but nonetheless, it could be assistance.
It could be assistance. And the other part, though, Your Honor, as far as the knowing component of it, and that addresses, you know, why was this done? And the only testimony in the record, and even that cited by Justice Lee, is that she didn't want, Mrs. Lozano didn't want her son's picture in a public place, and he didn't want him put in that role.
And the jury could choose to disbelieve that.
They could choose to disbelieve it, but you can't ask the jury, in my view, to believe the opposite. I mean, you can't go in and say, if somebody says yes and say, that person's lying and it should be no, and therefore you can conclude that the answer was no.
What if the jury believed Blanca? And that is, she didn't want her son's picture in a public place because if her son's picture was seen, then maybe somebody would think, I saw that guy. Maybe this missing girl is with that guy.
Your Honor,
of course she wouldn't want her son's picture in a public place because that could help locate the child.
And Your Honor, in my view, that gets to surmise and speculation over and above. Because then you're starting to guess what's in, literally guess what's in her mind.
Well, then help me understand this. In a child abduction case, I'm going to guess about 100% of the time, you're never going to have someone say, oh, yeah, I know where the kid is at trial. It's always going to be based upon surmise, inferences, circumstantial evidence.
Your Honor, I think it would be the type of circumstantial evidence that you see in Weirich and Smith, where they admitted, I agree with the court, that there's that typically, I mean, you might expect somebody to disagree, although under oath, I mean, I would hope they would tell the truth. I believe my clients did. But nonetheless, they certainly would deny knowledge. But there's all this evidence in Weirich and Smith about that there were actually visits, there was actually...
Well, then why isn't that direct evidence as opposed to circumstantial evidence?
Your Honor,
that's not a circumstantial evidence case, is it?
It's discussed in the context of just that some of those items are circumstantial, and I agree some are direct.
Yeah,
it's actually visited and gave money.
Let me ask you this. Do you disagree with Ms. Eichelberger's position that in reviewing this record to determine whether there is legally sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict, we do not look at each of the pieces of evidence in isolation, but rather look at the totality of the evidence presented to determine whether or not the jury could have made reasonable inferences and therefore there was legally sufficient evidence?
Your Honor, I think that the court on reviewing the courts of appeals are entitled to and need to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, I mean, is it...
I was just going to say, Your Honor, where I disagree is with the argument that she made, that Petitioner's Counsel made in her argument and in the brief, and that is all reasonable inferences contrary to the jury verdict must be rejected.
Well, I understand, but if you were the drafter of an opinion reviewing circumstantial evidence, would you be writing the opinion looking at this piece of evidence and say, no, as to this piece, no reasonable evidence, there's no reasonable inference the jury could have drawn. As to this piece, there's no reasonable inference. Or would your opinion recite the evidence that was presented and determine, based on the inferences that can be drawn from the totality of the evidence presented, that a reasonable inference could be drawn. It seems to me that that's a very big difference in the way a case would be reviewed when circumstantial evidence is presented. Which way would your opinion
be? Your Honor, I would say that under the totality of the circumstances, the evidence suffices or doesn't suffice to show that the inference drawn in support of the verdict is more reasonable than, if you will, innocent inferences, which is a different standard than I think is proposed by the petitioner.
Which way would your opinion look?
It would say that based on the totality of the circumstances, in this case, the totality of the circumstances.
Generally, if you're reviewing circumstantial evidence, are you going to write an opinion? You're the judge, and you're going to write an opinion. Is it going to go through and talk about posters being taken down and say, this piece, you can't draw a reasonable inference? Is it then going to go to not answering phone calls or not returning them or not being candid in phone calls, this piece doesn't? Or are you going to recite all that circumstantial evidence and then determine whether or not, based on the totality of that, the jury could reasonably infer that there was concealment or aiding and abetting and so on? Which way is your opinion going to look?
Your Honor, the issue that I would phrase for purposes of opinion is whether the totality of the circumstances indicate that the inference supporting the verdict is more reasonable than innocent inference.
I understand, but I need help writing this opinion, and I want to know how I'm going to get there and what it's going to look like so that I can make that conclusion, draw that conclusion that you just stated. How am I going to actually conduct the review? I've described to you two different ways that I could write that opinion, and you're the judge. I need to know what your opinion is going to look like so that you can draw that conclusion.
Between those two, I would take the totality of the circumstances.
So you take the second option?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Just briefly on the Fifth Amendment issue.
Your time has expired the way you put it up.
Okay. I would just mention just to take one more minute, with permission, we've discussed it. But in the Denton case, which was cited, it says specifically that the court can allow a jury to make a negative inference. There was no request for sanctions, and if the court will look at the appellate briefing, indeed there was no request that that inference be drawn. If the petitioner never asked the Court of Appeals to draw it, it only went to this obstruction issue. So there were no sanctions motions or no instruction to provide that inference to the jury. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I represent one of the respondents, Sandra Warner, who is a sister of Juan Jr. Before I get started on my remarks, I wanted to address an answer to Justice Hankinson's question. I believe Your Honor was correct in talking about totality of the circumstances. I think Your Honor would agree with Dorsanio, who says in an article that he supplied for an advanced appellate practice seminar last year, and this is a quote from one of his footnotes, that where you're talking about meager circumstantial evidence cases, which this is, or any circumstantial evidence case where it's weak circumstantial evidence, he says it appears that the reasonableness of the inferences that the fact finder may draw from the evidence as a whole must be evaluated in light of all facts and circumstances. So I think the answer is yes, you look at it in light of all the facts and circumstances in a meager circumstantial evidence case. And that's what this court did in Ortiz versus Jones.
With that test, you said the reasonableness of the inferences must be evaluated.
Yes.
And so by defining it that way, what you're saying is we as a court just decide whether or not the inferences drawn in favor of the plaintiffs were reasonable.
That's correct, because
just so I understand your framework, if we conclude that the inferences drawn in favor of the plaintiff are reasonable, then the verdict should be sustained.
If it meets the standards, the other standards that this court set forth, that you can't stack inference on inference, and if it also meets the standard that it doesn't consist of mere surmise or speculation, because those are the first two tests that I want to discuss, because for over 100 years, this court has said, and it started out in Joske versus Irvine in 1898, where the court held that evidence that creates a mere surmise or suspicion of the fact sought to be established is no evidence. And that's critically important here because of the knowledge that's required under the issue number two that the jury found, and that is that they had knowledge that their conduct was going to aid or abet Juan Jr. in violating the court order. Now, as to Sandra, it's really critically important because there's absolutely no evidence that she knew that her brother was going to do anything with the daughter. And the reason it's important to frame it that way for Ms. Warner is even the dissent, Justice Lee, doesn't disagree that there is no evidence to support the jury's verdict as against Sandra. He talks about some of the other respondents, but even the dissent in that case, in the Lozano opinion, doesn't say that there's any evidence to support.
Was Sandra the one with the large check that was cashed?
Yes.
And when was that cashed?
Well, the evidence is unclear of when it was cashed. There's direct evidence that it was given to him 3 weeks before his birth, 3 weeks before he was last seen. It was given to him on March the 21st.
And this was usual? Given that type of check to him was usual?
The testimony was that his birthday, she gave him the check, mailed him the check 3 days before his birthday, which was the 24th. And that she wrote on the front of the check, "Happy birthday," and RTNR, which she testified was her abbreviation for retainer. While he had a job, or the evidence may be that he was sporadically employed, he was in some financial, he wasn't flush financially, and neither was Sandra, but he was trying to retain a new lawyer for his divorce action.
But in answer to Justice Ennis' question, this is the only time that Sandra had ever given him anything even remotely close to that amount of money.
I think the evidence is that there is no evidence that they gave any amount to him, but there is evidence that, for example, that her husband's brother was given $1,500 several years before when he was in financial difficulty. So it's not like this $1,000 is out of the blue. It does have some background as far as family members.
I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel.
May I please support? I would like to address, first of all, Sandra's attorney's remarks concerning no evidence as to Sandra's aid and assistance. There is direct evidence of the $1,000 check. Now, there is also, despite her attorney's remarks in his brief, that there's no evidence in the record that she ever went to Cancun. I believe if you look at the statement of facts on page 928, her mother testified to a question concerning the trip to Cancun and who all went. Answer: my husband, my daughter, my son, and Sandra. Some evidence. Disregarding her testimony and taking the testimony favorable to the jury, she was there, as you have to do under the no evidence
standard. But what is the significance of her being in Cancun? How did you ever tie that up to anything?
It has to do with her pleading in her answers to interrogatories objecting as to time frame and speculation. And Justice Lee, it's one of the things Justice Lee quotes in his dissent, that the answer does not match the actions and could lead a jury to reasonably infer it was done for delay. As to witness credibility, the court's not free. The Court of Appeals was not free to judge these witnesses' credibility. Now, Mr. Restrepo says that he believes all these witnesses told the truth. But all these witnesses testified that a Mr. Berman, an attorney, and a Mr. Durham helped them fill out their answers to interrogatories, their request for admissions. Mr. Lozano testified he took the Fifth on the advice of Mr. Durham, Mr. Berman. Mr. Berman never testified. Mr. Durham testified that he'd never seen those papers. He had never helped fill them out. In fact, when asked if he would be surprised that they had testified that way, he said, I certainly would. If the test is, there is some evidence more than a scintilla, if the evidence furnishes some reasonable basis for differing conclusions by reasonable minds as to the existence of a vital fact, quoting the dissenting opinion of Justice Hightower in Transport Insurance Company versus Faircloth, then if reasonable minds can reach differing conclusions, isn't the answer some evidence? Reasonable minds did.
What if in a criminal case the prosecutor's only witness is the defendant himself? The prosecutor calls the defendant to the stand and says, did you commit the crime? And the defendant says no. Is the jury free to choose to believe or disbelieve that and convict the defendant?
Yes, ma'am.
With no other evidence?
Yes, ma'am. No, I'm sorry, because the burden of proof is on the state, and it's beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think if you had any other evidence than the defendant standing up there and saying no, then you haven't met your beyond a reasonable doubt burden. This whole case rests on credibility of the witnesses and their testimony. Aid and assistance after the time, over $3,000 by Eduardo, pulled out of credit cards on cash advances. He testified he thinks he gave the money to Juan Sr. or his sister, but it's cash. It's untraceable cash. There's no place, nothing you can do with it. It could have been sent to a post office box somewhere in Mexico. He says he could have given assistance up until that time.
How much did Eduardo make a year?
I believe the testimony was about $5,500 that year, which would amount to a substantial sum. Now, Juan Sr. testified that all he provided was bed and food, and yet when he went and cashed his savings check that he withdrew from Exxon, there was $2,000 that he says he handed to Eduardo. Again, it's cash. He said it was to pay a loan at the very same credit card company, that very same credit union they were standing at. Well, I find that a little unusual. You withdraw $3,000, $2,000, hand it to your son and say, here, pay your loan, we're standing. It's just as easily done through a transfer. I believe if you apply the standard in this case, then there's no way the Court of Appeals could have reached the verdict without giving witness, without judging the credibility of the witnesses, the Lozanos. And in fact, in one part of their opinion, they state that Mr. Lozano testified that he took the Fifth Amendment on the advice of counsel because his counsel did not know whether or not he knew the whereabouts. But nowhere in the record is that testimony. The only place it's in the record is in a bill of exceptions, which never went before the jury, concerning Mr. Berman's testimony. I would just like to address the four or five posters. There were only four or five posters admitted to, but the jury, Dina testified that hundreds of posters were taken down. They disappeared nightly. She had to go back and put them back up the next day. The jury could easily have inferred that just because they were caught with four or five, and the reason they were caught taking four or five is because they were behind glass in office buildings, that they could just as easily have taken down the hundreds of others. Again.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.